It's sunset, and I have just arrived at the most stunning location in Mexico. We have beautiful, pristine water conditions, 30 meters of visibility. And as I drop in, I see the tiny little island suddenly evolve into this enormous mountain that descends down to about 40 meters. And as I drop down and I watch the freedivers as they drop quickly to the bottom and then sprint back to the surface, I feel so lucky that I'm on scuba because I can savor every single moment as I drop down into the deep. And the other thing that is so special about being on scuba is that every time I breathe out my bubbles, I see a manta ray creeping closer and closer to me. He is lured in by the idea of a bubble bath. And within just a few minutes, he's hanging over my head and doing somersaults around me. It's one of those moments that I'm looking up and I can see him making perfect eye contact with me, staring back. And as I continue to play with the manta ray, as I'm always getting pushed deeper and deeper, I see an entire pod of dolphins swim past me. And a young baby dolphin turns around and looks directly at me, swims out of the pod, and starts to swim next to me. And at this point, I am kicking as hard as I can to keep up because the currents are raging. However, the dolphins make it look completely effortless, and I'm once again reminded that I am human and not a mermaid, as I wish that I was. Why we're here is so important because we will be able to protect these species because of the samples that we've been collecting on that dive.
Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to season two of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid, intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet. What's up, mermaids? It's Danny Washington here, and I am very excited to introduce our next guest, Inka Creswell. She is a filmmaker, marine biologist, and wildlife photographer. She's traveled the world exploring our ocean and has told so many beautiful stories from beneath the waves. And I'm just thrilled to have her on the show today because she's not only a consummate professional in the space, but also one of my friends. And we've been able to connect online over the last 3 years, but have yet to meet in person. So one day we will meet. I know that'll happen. But again, I'm so excited to have her on 21st Century Mermaids. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. So let's go. So let's talk about how you became interested in the ocean. When was the moment that you remember feeling, wow, this is for me?
It's really hard when I try and think about what was that moment that really inspired me, because the ocean has always been such a huge part of my life. And trying to kind of pinpoint that specific encounter is so difficult because I grew up by the ocean, and it was my normal everyday activity was going and exploring the waves and exploring the rock pools and swimming in the sea. And I think it's just always been such a huge part of my life.
And so what are your earliest memories of being in the ocean? Were you just swimming or snorkeling? What was that like?
I think one of my earliest memories are rock pooling on my local beach. And I'm from Brighton on the south coast of England. And there's this amazing place called Black Rock. And it's just kind of beyond the tourist beaches. And it's kind of a little hideaway spot that's always quiet and beautiful. And when the tide pools back there, you just get all of these stunning rock pools that reveal. And at the right time of year, you can find mermaid's purses and different shark egg cases and all sorts of amazing things. And I just thought it was like just this treasure chest of stuff that you could find. So I have really fun memories of kind of exploring those waters. But I was also very fortunate that I got to travel a lot when I was younger. So I was exposed to coral reefs and big pelagic life at a really young age. And I just always thought this ocean was just this magical place that I just always wanted to spend more time in.
I think when certain folks might think of England, they wouldn't necessarily assume someone from there would be in love with the ocean compared to someone who's maybe from the islands or from a, you know, tropical type of place. I know that's pretty cliche, but honestly, I've met people who talk about that, like, you're from the UK and you like the ocean? Like, what? Isn't it cold? Isn't it like hard to get in? I mean, some of those things are true, but what is it about the shoreline, you know, around the UK and where you're from that was so special?
I couldn't agree more. A lot of people don't understand just how special the UK waters are. And it's something that I think I've discovered a lot more in recent years. The diving here is incredible. And we have the most outstanding kelp forests that are full of seals that will come and chew on your fins and nibble on your head and bite at your camera. And there's other dive sites that you can go to where you literally are surrounded by 40 plus blue sharks that will come and bump you. And there's those kinds of encounters. I think when I was younger, I always thought you have to be someone who travels to the Bahamas to be able to experience shark diving like that. But the reality is that we have all of that right here. We have octopus, we have cuttlefish, we have all sorts of amazing life. The ocean conditions are definitely a little bit scarier and a little bit harder to handle. So you have to be a little bit more thick-skinned. But it's fantastic, and it's such a special place to explore.
Love that. So when did you realize that you could contribute to protecting the ocean?
I think for me, it was when I was at university. Before, I knew I wanted to study marine biology from the time that I was about 6 years old. But back then, I wanted to be someone who studied behavior. I wanted to understand why whales sing different songs, how dolphins communicate, why species act a certain way. And I just thought that was fascinating. And I used to study people like Jane Goodall and was fascinated by their work. And I was like, what if I could do that in the ocean? Wouldn't that be amazing to understand things in that level of detail? But when I was at university, I think for me, behavior studies almost just started to feel like a luxury. And I think the more that I was kind of confronted with the harsh realities of what our oceans are facing and overfishing and pollution and all of these other horrific things that are taking place, I just felt like I had to do something that was a lot more active in addressing those issues. And that was how I ended up kind of going down more the conservation route. And I also wanted to figure out where I fitted. And for me, I've always been someone who's very artistic. And while I loved science, it wasn't ever something that came naturally to me. It was something I had to work really hard at. And that was okay with me because I was so passionate about it. But the film and the photography side just came naturally. So it was great to kind of find a way that I could piece those things together.
Do you have a particular set of photographs or a photograph that you think really showcased not only your talent, but the story that you wanted to convey? Like that light bulb moment when you knew that your imagery and the storytelling that you were doing was impactful for those who saw it.
I think one of my favorite photos is a photo that I named The Bow. And it is a great white shark and it's going straight towards me, but it's bended its body in a way that looks so submissive. And to see something that is almost like we know is such kind of an aggressive apex predator, mindless, all of these things, these buzzwords that we hear around sharks all the time. And to see it looking so vulnerable, I think just had it. It shifted my perspective in that moment. And I think that it's a really powerful image for those reasons, because you see it and you suddenly go, oh, this is something that is vulnerable to us. And we do have a huge impact on them. And you can be the biggest fish in the sea and you're still at risk from humans.
Okay, I think we need to backtrack for a second because you just said that you're underwater with a great white shark. That's not something that people do every day. Even if you're an avid scuba diver, the chances of seeing a great white are pretty slim. Like you have to be very intentional about being with them underwater. Where were you when you took that photograph and how did that transpire?
So that photograph I took in Guadeloupe off Mexico, and I was very fortunate to be out there working on a photo series. And I was actually with my dad. He's also a passionate underwater photographer. So he kind of threw me in at the deep end from a young age. And shark diving is something me and him have always done together. I think we did our first shark dive together when I was about 5 or 6. And
what? When you were 5 or 6?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think one of my first memories snorkeling with my dad was us kind of me kicking my hardest, trying to keep up, being about 5 years old, and him just going, there's a shark, swim faster, you're going to miss it. And I was instantly just like, oh my God, this is this amazing thing and I'm going to miss it if I can't be fast enough. And sharks just weren't the scary encounter. They were this thing that you needed to experience.
How beautiful. Wow. And for your dad to introduce you to the ocean in that way, that's powerful. Now, I know that we share something very special together, our heritage. Your dad, I believe, is Jamaican, correct?
My mother's Jamaican.
Your mother. Okay, so it's the same. Okay, both of us have Jamaican mothers. Love that. How has your Jamaican heritage impacted your view of the world?
Yeah, my mom absolutely loves the ocean, and she is such an island girl at heart. And even though she's born and raised from London, as soon as we're kind of in that coral reef environment, she's immediately just like, oh, this is where I should be. This is where I belong. And she's taught me this amazing love for our oceans, and through her food, and just through her warmness and her kindness and her understanding of people. And I think that that's where my mom has influenced me so much, is that she has this incredible ability to connect with people all around the world. And I think that that's such a valuable tool when it comes to conservation, to really kind of see beyond like the issues that you might see at first glance, and instead to understand the community and understand the culture and understand why things are important. And I think, she's taught me a lot of that side of things. And I think it's been a huge help when it comes to conservation and advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I definitely, that resonates with me a lot, because my mom has taught me similar ideas. And what I love about the Jamaican cultural side of things is that, yes, we're super inclusive. Everyone, I think, has like a good feeling, a warm feeling when we talk about Jamaica, because it's that special. And the way that all these cultures can come together and be, you know, under one human identity, that I think truly permeates throughout Jamaican ideology and the way that, you know, Jamaicans think. And I just love that. And as you said, it truly can inform your conservation efforts, because we've seen in the past where conservation projects have come in and parachuted into a location and not taken into consideration what is the human culture of that space, what's the heritage there, how many people have already been doing that same work. And it's all about how you begin that conversation with those who are immersed in that conservation space. That's where I think the change will happen, and that's the only way conservation will happen.
I couldn't agree more, 100%. And I think, yeah, it is. It's that sense of community that is just so, so valuable. And I personally think that the best thing you can do for our oceans and conservation is to create marine protected areas, but they have to be done in partnership with those local communities. You have to understand the needs. You have to understand the culture. You have to understand why certain things are important, and ensure that they are part of that process. Yeah, it's a really valuable lesson. And I think that the more I work in the conservation and the filmmaking space, the more I try and bring those narratives into my storytelling.
So a normal day of work for you, what is a day in the life of Inca Cresswell?
It varies so much. At the moment, I'm working on a big project, which is a big blue chip series called Our Oceans, which is for Netflix. And it's a really exciting project. We actually just officially announced it the other day, and it's coming out in 2024. And when I'm working on that project, some days I am just on the phone to scientists, reading scientific papers, trying to get the greatest understanding of what these new behaviors are. And then sometimes I'm faced with the question of, okay, there's this incredible piece of behavioral research in our marine space. It's never been filmed before. How do you do it? And that's the crux of all of these questions, is sometimes it's a remote location that's 4 days travel to get to. Maybe you're working with a really big predator that can be quite aggressive, or maybe you need to have your entire team working at 40 meters where they're doing deep technical diving. And I have to kind of figure out all the logistics around how I can make that a reality so that we can bring that science and bring those stories to the screen. And then the fun part of my job is when I actually get to execute those plans. And those filming days are intense, and I'm very lucky that I get to direct in the field, and I get to work a lot underwater with some fantastic camera operators and scientists. And I lean so heavily on those scientists to make sure that I am portraying their research in the best possible light. And luckily, I work with a fantastic team of creatives, and we work on building those stories so that we can take something that was just once a research paper and really build it into something that is exciting and shows all of that passion and all of that time that's been dedicated into that research.
Now, I know that you're a filmmaker and a photographer, but you also spent a significant amount of time in front of the camera as well. So is this project featuring you as a host?
No, not at all. This one is entirely blue chip natural history behavior. So it's a really nice step away from that stuff for me. But it's been really exciting. The behind the scenes aspect and the kind of more social media and digital side, I'll be doing some things that are a little bit more to camera. But the actual main series is almost the style of something like Planet Earth or Blue Planet.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So for those who don't know, blue chip is a term that covers that type of filmmaking where it's really observational and immersive, where you feel like you're just underwater in whatever habitat and you're there to front and center to witness something incredible.
Exactly. No, you absolutely nailed it. And the thing that I love about working on that type of programming is that we really work hand in hand with the science. So it is all about bringing new science to the camera, and we get to dedicate huge amounts of time to working in those spaces, often in a way that scientists don't have access to. And we get to bring in all of the toys and the scientific equipment and then all of the technical equipment, like the rebreathers. And we'll spend, like the shoot that I just finished, I was doing 4 to 5 hours a day just staring at one fish.
I love it.
And it was fantastic. And I got to film it doing all sorts of incredible things. And then I get to go back to the scientists and go, have you ever seen it do this before? And it's like all this data you get to share with people.
Oh, yeah. That's the beauty of SciComm and filmmaking and photography, is that you can take that information, those images, and present them to the leading scientists who are working on whatever, you know, that subject is, and give them more information about what they need to know. And that's powerful. So how did you leverage your creativity in combination with your scientific knowledge? Some people have a hard time distinguishing that you can do both. It doesn't have to be either or. And then the second part of that question is, when you collaborate with scientists, how do they tend to tell you the information they want you to know, and how do you translate it?
All fantastic questions. In terms of that connection between art and science, it's something I struggled with at first. I think when I went to university and went into marine biology, I was just like, okay, I have to be a marine biologist. And then I remember talking to my professor and trying to explain what I wanted to do, and them just going, that's not a job. And I was just like, I really think it is. And having this back and forth with my university professor on like how I could make a career out of this. And it is, in fact, a job. It's a really important job as science communication. But it definitely took a lot of kind of exposing that scientific community to the media world for them to even know how to support me in making that journey and making that transition. And I was very lucky that I was accepted onto a master's program to do a master's in wildlife filmmaking. And that program specializes in taking people from an academic background and putting them into that creative space. And I think it was a tricky transition at first, because you're so used to writing in such a scientific mindset where you don't have an opinion. And then all of a sudden you're making something creatively where having an opinion can be really important. You need to guide that story. You need to be emotive with it. And you actually rely more heavily on emotion than you do on fact at times, because you want it to connect with your audience. And it was something that I'd played around with my photography more and more. But I think that as I started to kind of understand that storytelling side from the creative side, it impacted so much on how I frame my images and how I think about things in the field. And it's like just knowing what I do about shark conservation from the work that I've done in the shark conservation space. When I'm photographing a shark now, I don't just think I want to take a pretty picture of a shark. I think, oh, how can I frame this so that the fin is the most important thing? Or how can I frame this to show a different side of it? Or how can I make the species feel really small in a really vast environment? Or how can I make my habitat show its strengths and make that more of the kind of the primary focus as opposed to the species? And you kind of think, if when you start thinking in that way, all the creative and the scientific kind of just like melts together in a really nice way of working.
That's beautiful. I love it. And so how did you learn your camera skills beyond the master's program? Was it really just about in the field experience, or did you have any mentors that helped you along the way?
I had a lot of mentors who guided me. I never had any kind of formal training, but I was very lucky in the sense that because my dad is a photographer, I learned to dive when I was 11 years old, and he gave me my first disposable camera when I was about 12 or 13. So he would give me critiques all the time and teach me how to do different things. And that was always really helpful. And then as I started moving into it more professionally, after graduating, I worked for an organization called the Waterman Project. And we traveled around the world doing shark tagging, which was so much fun and a really fantastic, lot of field experience. And I was able to work with a very talented freediver and photographer called William Winram and another freediving photographer called Lucas Müller. And the two of them gave me so much advice on camera settings and how to get the best out of my camera and how to frame certain shots different ways. So I learned from them a lot during that time. And then I became an underwater photography instructor and spent a while teaching out in Indonesia, but I was still learning kind of the video skills. And then I was again, very lucky to be supported by a brilliant organization called Girls at Scuba. And they sent me on a trip with Behind the Mask, where I met Florian, who is a fantastic cinematographer. And Florian gave me guidance on how I should be filming. And then I went off and made my own film. And I was very lucky that I was contacting all these people being like, I'm having this problem. How do I do this? Or can I get feedback on this? And some fantastic mentors have really just guided me every step of the way.
It's really tricky when you're underwater. You've got this huge housing to hold your camera. Usually the housing is more expensive than the camera itself.
Yeah.
And, you're dealing with possible leakage or just any kind of tech issue. When you're underwater and you're diving, like, you have a limited amount of time and energy and ability to fix problems in the moment. What's been the most challenging shoot that you've done so far?
Oh, that's a really good question. The most challenging, it was a shoot that I was working on recently, which I can't give too much information about.
No worries.
But it was working at 34 meters. It was a predation sequence. There were big predators involved. We had 20 minutes every dive because you're working at such a deep depth. And that was really challenging because you're kind of waiting for this behavior to occur, but you also have such limited time to do it. So we had to be so focused on our approach for everything. And that was really challenging. So I think when you get into that deep technical space, it just adds a whole other level. And something that I've learned a lot with underwater photography and filmmaking as well, when I am acting as the camera operator, is that you have to be 100% prepared for that shot when it emerges. A lot of what we do is like you can go in with the best storyboard and the best script and exactly the idea of what you want to happen, but you have to be ready for the unexpected. You need to be ready to completely switch what your plan is if something amazing happens. And that's not the moment to be playing around with your shutter or your ISO and trying to do your color balance. Like, you need to be ready to immediately switch gears and be ready for that. So that's always challenging. And that was why I did a lot of time working with film as well. So doing film photography where you only have 32 shots, that really kind of just makes you think a lot about your camera settings because you can't second guess it. So you don't do that digital thing where you just fire off 100 shots. You're very decisive with every shot that you take. And I think a lot of that skill set kind of carries over to when you're working on digital, when you're working in cinematography, because you're used to that kind of very specific approach.
So did you get the shot?
Yes.
Yes. Excellent. Well, we can't wait to see it for sure.
Always
I know
good.
I can't wait. Excellent. So you've talked about your new series that's coming out in 2024. That sounds like a significant triumph and major mark on your trajectory and your career. But what are some of the other obstacles that you've faced as a woman of color in wildlife photography, filmmaking, and marine science in general?
I think one of the hardest things is getting people to kind of acknowledge me as the person in charge at times. And when I've been doing some of my own film shoots and it's just like, hi, I'm the director. And they would just address the conversation straight past me to the person who's assisting me because he's a white man. And you're just like, no, eyes back on me. I'm the one who's calling the shots. And you're having to constantly kind of redirect people. And that can be really challenging and disheartening. I've actually found that the last couple of shoots that I've been on, that's really changed.
Wow.
And I think that people are getting a lot more accepting and understanding of it. And I don't know if it's the way that I'm kind of portraying myself and that I'm getting more confident in my role, that I'm saying things with more certainty, but I have felt that shift. And I've had the opportunity to work with some fantastic camera operators who ask my creative input and they want to be directed and they want that advice. And that's just so refreshing because I think previously I would always be nervous to give my input because of all these other kind of concerns of, oh, what are they going to think of me? Like, who's going to want to take direction from this little black girl who's clearly the youngest on the team? but it's nice to feel valued in that way.
That's awesome. Wow. And I think, I mean, sounds like, yeah, once you've stepped into your power and you realize and recognize that you have something to offer in that space, I mean, the sky's the limit.
Absolutely. And it is challenging, I think, just gaining that confidence. And I still have so much imposter syndrome with everything that I do. But I think that the more I'm putting myself into that space, the more comfortable I'm slowly getting.
Trial by fire.
Yeah. A lot of fire.
Just jump in. Yeah, that I can totally relate to that because working in television myself, it's always a new scenario. And like you're meeting new people constantly who you have to collaborate with very closely. And so building rapport with the people on your crew is essential because that's, for me, the best way to convey a message. When I do have input, when I have something to share, a creative idea, it's like, okay, look, we're eye to eye, right? We're here, we're all on the same level. let's collaborate and make this truly a unified process. And that's honestly one of the biggest things that I love about storytelling on camera, is that you cannot do it without your crew. And it teaches you about human behaviors a lot and ego and dealing with all those things at the same time. And so I just love what you just shared about your experience, because yeah, that's a common occurrence where, you know, women of color especially are overlooked in that space as in a position of authority or of someone who can provide knowledge in that space. But that's changing slowly but surely. I love it. That's great. Talk to me about the nuances related to communities that you worked with. We mentioned a little bit about culture and what that informs within conservation, but how do you personally relate to the communities that you meet and document?
I think it's a really difficult one, because I find that every community I meet is so unique. And I think you can always find common ground. And I find that common ground is often the way that we all have that connection to the ocean, and that we all have that love for it, and we all have those stories that have been passed on generation to generation. And I think that there's always that common ground in that space. But ultimately what I found is that if you kind of go into any of these kind of conservation stories with a blanket approach or with too much of a preconceived idea as to how it's going to go, you're not telling the right story. You've got to listen to the environment. You've got to learn from them. And often that means stepping outside of your comfort zone and trying to find ways to relate. And maybe you can't, because they have such a different experience, but it's kind of appreciating that that experience is just as valid and just as important. One of the communities I was working with, I was out in Yap, and they were just, their knowledge of the ocean far surpassed anything that I knew. And like, what we share is a passion for the ocean. I had formal training as a marine biologist. He didn't have any formal training, but in my eyes, he's 100% a marine biologist, because of his knowledge was just unbelievable, of every type of spawning aggregation and all of the history of these species and where to find them and what happens on one reef, how that'll impact another. And it's just so much incredible indigenous knowledge that's there as well that I think that we can learn from. And I wish I had more of that in my own culture.
Absolutely. Indigenous knowledge is passed down generation to generation, and understanding, like you said, the timing of certain events and knowing where certain species are located. I mean, you can't pay money for that. It's so valuable. And I think that as marine conservationists, I think it's important that we all lean more on indigenous knowledge and wisdom and let that lead our path forward, rather than just looking at it as something separate from us, because indigenous knowledge it's inherently connected to humanity. And from what I've gathered, seeing humans as a part of nature rather than apart from it, that's really the essence of what it means to connect. And I love that. And every different indigenous culture has something new to teach as well. So on that note, how do we build more empathy, cultivating empathy for the ocean on an individual level and a community level? How do we do that?
I think it's really important that we pass the mic a little bit more. And when it comes to kind of conservation storytelling, that we ensure that we have a huge variety of perspectives. And the way that I always say it is, it's like, I work with an incredible team of people, but somebody who is a white man in their 60s is going to have a very different perspective to me. They will be a fantastic filmmaker, probably a brilliant ocean conservationist, but the audience they will reach will be very different to my audience. So it's not about one or the other. It's about creating more people that are sharing those messages, that are connecting to their local audiences, that are telling their stories, the stories of their community, and getting a little bit more of a global perspective on the issue. And I think that if we can empower people from a huge variety of communities to tell their stories of their connections to the ocean, of the work their community is doing, about the struggles that their communities are facing, and we increase our representation, then we will increase the amount of people that care about our oceans, because in my eyes, passion is hugely infectious. I think that if you can talk about something with enough excitement, enough passion, you can get so many people on board. And I just want there to be more people out there spreading those messages. And I think that media is a fantastic way to give people that platform.
Absolutely. So 21st Century Mermaids, our podcast is officially an activity of the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development, which is occurring between now and 2030. And we're fully in support of the goal of protecting at least 30% of the ocean by 2030. Tell us how you've been able to contribute to the achievement of this massive goal.
I've worked with a lot of different organizations that are studying vulnerable marine ecosystems in all different corners of the planet. And I think that a lot of the time we don't even understand the way that species are utilizing these habitats or what are the most important areas to be protected, and being able to kind of support that science has been amazing. But as well as that, it's empowering your local community. And for me, that's through different talks and panels and talking to a huge variety of kids at all different levels as well about why they should be passionate about their local marine ecosystems. Just this year, I hosted the World Ocean Day for Kids, which was fantastic. And we reached, I think it was 26 countries and over 30,000 kids, teaching them all about the ocean and connecting them with all different conservation organizations. And what's really beneficial about that type of outreach is it's like we're creating an entire generation of ocean advocates who will be wanting to implement those things. So yeah, just working with a huge variety of people, there's so many ways that you can support it. It's a hard one.
And how can our listeners support the work that you're doing at this moment and going forward?
At the moment, a lot of what I'm doing is under wraps, which is really tricky. But on my website, inkaquestwild.com, that's where you can see all of the latest events. There's always different talks and panels going on, links to lots of petitions and organizations that I'm working with. And I'm also always sharing different media that I make in collaboration with different marine organizations, sharing their work and the importance of the ocean conservation work they're doing.
When you think about the future of the ocean, what type of vision do you have in mind? What do you hope for by 2030? What do you see happening?
I would love to see a healthier ocean. And I think that it is absolutely achievable. But I do think that we need to let go of this idea that we can just conserve our oceans. I don't want to conserve what we have. I want to restore. I want to see a different ocean for the future, and that can mean that we are investing more into coral restoration, that we're having more respect for these indigenous practices, that we're changing the way that fishing subsidies work. All of those things, I think, need to shift. And I think it's a really challenging question, because what we could build by 2030, I think, will be different to anything we've ever seen before. But there is the chance that it could be healthier. And that for me is exciting.
Beautiful. All right. So now time for some fun. This podcast, as you know, features women who we believe embody the spirit of a mermaid, and they also work in the ocean science space, but also marine conservation. What's your personal interpretation of a mermaid?
Ooh, my interpretation of a mermaid is somebody who lives and breathes the ocean, who has salt water in their veins and can't get the ocean off their mind.
Great. If you could be a mermaid in real life, which you already are, but as far as like growing a tail and doing all that, where would you choose to live? Which part of the ocean?
Where would I live? I think I'd live in Revilla Quijera, which is the national park off of Mexico. It is a series of seamounts and volcanoes, and it is the most abundant place I have ever been, with just dolphins everywhere and whales that pass through and schooling sharks. And the first dive I did there, I just felt like I'd stepped into an aquarium. And I just remember thinking, I can't believe places like this still exist. And that to me is a really special place. And I'd love to just hang out there all day.
That's awesome. That's off the coast of Baja, right? In the Gulf of California?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite places in the world. So tell us more about the manta and the baby dolphin that you interacted with in Baja.
So I was traveling with an organization called the Watermen Project, and our goal was actually to tag scalloped hammerheads. And as we had been working there, we basically realized that we were struggling a lot to find the scalloped hammerheads. They can be incredibly elusive and shy for such big sharks. So the plan was for me to go on scuba and so that I could document the freediver's work. And they were working with these amazing modified spear guns that had satellite tags attached to the end. And through those, you could tag these hammerheads in a way that was really non-invasive, because a lot of the tagging work that we do with sharks requires them to being pulled up onto a boat, can cause a lot of stress for the animal. So this in-water approach, while is a lot more challenging, can allow us to have a much more kind of hands-off approach and still get this essential data. And we were also taking biopsies of the manta rays. And I remember one of the things that really stood out to me on that trip was there was one manta ray that we took a biopsy of, and it's you're essentially taking a pole and piercing the manta ray's skin, which sounds quite painful. And the manta ray, you could see it flinch as the biopsy was taken, but it didn't run away. It kind of turned, looked at us, and then just hanged out and did a couple rolls around the divers and then just continued to watch us for the rest of the dive. And I felt like it knew that we were there to do something good for it. And it kind of, it felt like it appreciated us being there and us trying to do everything we could to protect them.
And what was the biopsy used for? What information were you trying to gather?
The biopsy was to get a better understanding of the genetics of the population so that we could understand how these different populations were linked. And what's really important about understanding how these populations are connected is it allows us to have better planning for marine parks so that you can start to go, okay, well, this population is supporting this population and therefore a marine corridor here could be really helpful. So the more that we can kind of understand that habitat use and the population genetics, then the better we can protect those species.
Perfect. That's it. Done. I love it. Inka, thank you so much. That was brilliant.
No worries. Lovely to talk to you.
"21st Century Mermaids" is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.